Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by EJAP.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Back 9 Report, presented by EJAP.com. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews, recaps, previews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Every week, I'm alongside my co-host, Fred Albader. Fred, hi, how are you this week?
Carlos, I'm fantastic. I am here in beautiful Gulf Shores, Alabama, and enjoying the weather, the golf, and outstanding accommodations down here. We have a great interview later in the show with Robert Kraft, the man responsible for creating the golf mecca in here in the Deep South. His story also has a Arnold Palmer twist. In addition, the 2017 PGA Tour kicked off this week in rainy California. Sayuri Pak got a hero send-off in Korea. And 10 young women earned LPGA Tour cards for next season. And that's just a tease, Carlos. We have a lot of golf news to talk about tonight, so let's go.
Let's go. And we have also on the practice range, we're going to talk about what is going on with live streaming, the future of television, cable television, and how it affects sports streaming and as well our golf tournament. So you don't want to miss that. But we're going to start.
We're going to look deep into the future tonight.
Don't give it away. Don't give it away. But
okay.
We have a letter from 2026. That's all I'm going to say.
We have a letter from 2026.
So you don't want to miss that. It's going to be interesting.
Back to the golf future on Back 9 Report.
That is how it's going to be. I cannot believe the PGA Tour started a season right now. I mean, what happened? I didn't know. I thought they started next year. Tell us about it. Who said it
doesn't rain in California? Well, they were wrong. The Safeway Classic fought rainy conditions and the Soak golf course all week last week, but did manage to get in the 72 holes to finish on Sunday. And Carlos, yes, that's the first event of the 2017 season. It's still only 2016. Thanksgiving and Christmas not even here yet. In 2015, Brendan Steele was in position to win the Safeway Classic, but a final round of plus four over par 76 moved him down to T17. His final round this year at the first event of the season for the PGA Tour was a little different story. He fired a final round 65, finishing with three straight birdies to get the win and earn redemption for his failed final round last year. Brendan is excited to earn an invitation to his second Masters. He missed the cut in 2012 in his first effort. Patton Kizzier made a bogey on the 12th on Sunday, followed with six straight pars, when just one more birdie would have got him into a playoff with Steele. Chip attended the final hole, ended up very close. On the bright side, he earned $648,000 for a runner-up finish at Silverado. Paul Casey, man, we've been talking about him a lot lately, came up just a little short again. In his last four starts, he's gone runner-up, runner-up, fourth, and third. He is hot right now. He was joined by Jonathan Wagner, Scott Piercy, and Michael Kim for the third-place finish. Phil Mickelson, we all remember him. He was in the Ryder Cup a couple weeks ago. He played his final event of the year and earned another top 10 coming in at T8. Did you see Morgan Hoffman's albatross on the first round last week at number 8? He had a 251-yard three-wood that found the bottom of the jar. What is with all of these 58s, 59s, albatrosses? are these guys that much better? I mean, it just seems like it's happening at an increasing rate. But anyhow, the Safeway Classic without Tiger Woods is in the books, Carlos, and the 2017 season is off and running.
Oh, my God. No, it can't be. It can't be. Well, it's the fall series to me. The season really starts next year, so I still don't accept that.
You got to get with the times, man. You got to get with the times. You're behind it. We're going. We're off.
No, not yet. But anyway, there was action on a tour that's still going, and that is their European Tour. And there, Alex Noren was already twice a winner on the European Tour this year at the Aberdeen Asset Management Scottish Open and also at the Omega European Masters. He finished two shots clear of Bernd Wiesberger at the Grove and won the British Masters. He was finished third, a further shot back. Noren, he started the rain-delayed final day, three shots ahead of the field, but his advantage had been pegged back to just one on the 11th, and a birdie from Wiesberger on the 15th brought the Austrian level. Noren struck back with a birdie of his own at the 15th, and he stayed two clear with two solid pars there at the 16th and 17th holes. He finished with another birdie to win by two. Some takeaways from this tournament, hey, this was Alex Noren's seventh European Tour victory. He moves now into the top 20 of the official World Golf Rankings for the first time. He sits now at number 18 and has won three of the last eight European Tour events, top almost 1.9 million euros in those tournaments. Pen this down here. Alex Noren, you'll be hearing a lot of him, and I assure you, he will be in the European Ryder Cup team in 2018. Lee Westwood, well, he showed some of his best form during the final round of 67 to end the week in third place, so he's making up a little bit for that letdown in the Ryder Cup. Two further Englishmen, Richard Bland and Tommy Fleetwood, they posted top five finishes, sharing fourth spot with Graham McDowell, Alexander Levy, and Peter Hansen. For Fleetwood, it was his best result of the season, although he has showed solid form over the last few months. Richard Bland has enjoyed a fine second half of this year. He has finished in the top 10 four times in his last six starts. The host, Luke Donald, hey, he has some news for everybody. He believes that the success of the British Masters can trigger a reversal in the decline of the tournament golf in England. Donald, who is the host of the Grove, cited a cumulative attendance of more than 110,000 over the 2 years since its revival as evidence that there's an appetite for more big events. There are just two England-based European Tour events on the schedule, but Donald is optimistic there's scope for more alongside May's BMW PGA Championship at Wentworth and the British Masters. The British Masters will now move on to the Close House near Newcastle next year, where Lee Westwood, who takes over now the hosting duties, hopes to take up will be even stronger. Foreign fans starve of live tour action since the demise of the Great North Open at Lely Hall in 2002. And last but not least, you know, Donald is not the only one taking positives out of the tournament. The European Tour Chief Executive Keith Pelly has led the chorus of approval for another successful staging of the British Masters supported by Sky Sports. The week at the Grove again attracted a high-quality field, and the condition of the course, particularly the quality of the greens, earned plaudits from the field, while the innovations for the tournament and the coverage won universal praise. Tuesday night's inaugural Hero Challenge, a one-hole knockout competition under floodlights featuring eight professionals and four celebrities, enjoyed a remarkable success and drew a bumper crowd despite the chilly conditions that night. That was won by Alexander Levy, who beat Alex Noren to win the Hero Challenge. The week also featured the ISPS Hand-Up Pressure Putt Challenge, which is a star-studded pro-am broadcast live on Sky Sports, and the Hito Masterclasses after each of the first three rounds. Again, it drew widespread praise from the fans and the viewers. In addition, Tim Barter was gaining insight from the players with his mid-round interviews during the tournament. That was a television first for a European Tour stroke play event. He was just talking with the players as they were walking from hole to hole. There he would talk to GMAC He talked to Luke Donald. He talked to Lee Westwood. He talked to Alex Noren. He talked to a variety of players, and that was the first done while they were playing. I tell you, the fans loved it, and there has been praises all around on the emulations. Keith Pelley, he keeps doing a great job with this. There is hope all around for a revival. Of course, economics will be the deciding factor, but every button Pelley has been pushing is the right one. Sooner rather than later, the European Tour could be seen as the innovator in golf and the one to follow if they continue this up. They're doing all the right things to attract new fans. With that comes bigger sponsors, and with that thread comes the big name players that they're hoping to attract.
Well, we're going to talk more about the European Tour here a little bit later, and I got some questions for you about Keith Pelley. Evidently it went well for him. So, hey, you mentioned Lee Westwood. I read something where somebody asked him about the putt at the Ryder Cup that he was missing, and he said he didn't lose too much sleep over that. He, you know, that's in the past, and he's moving on. So,
hey, Carl, water under the bridge.
It's over. Yeah, we're done with that. Hey, the Champions Tour had a tournament last week, the SAS Championship. Doug Garwood closed with a final round 8-under, 64, to run away with the SAS Championship on Sunday for his first Champions Tour title. 53-year-old Garwood won in his 44th start on the Champions Tour. He finished at 16-under in the regular season finale. Now, that's not right. They were at Prestwood Country Club, but there's two more tournaments left yet. It hasn't really settled in yet, Garwood said. Someone asked me last week when my last tournament win was, and I blanked. I couldn't think of one, so now I won't have too much trouble. Feels great. It was a great day. Played well. Beat a champion in Bernhard Langer and Larry Mize in my group. Uncharacteristically, Langer began the day in the lead, fired a final 70, and finished four back for runner-up. Larry Mize, Jeff Sluman, and Tom Byron finished 11-under for third place. With only two events remaining on the 2016 Champions Tour schedule before the season-ending Charles Schwab Cup Championship, guess what? Bernhard Langer still has that commanding lead with Miguel Angel Jimenez, Joe Durant, Colin Montgomery, and Woody Austin rounding out the top five for the million-buck Charles Schwab Cup. Carlos, you got any news about the LPGA next week? Or this week, last weekend?
Last weekend, yes. And that was about Carlota Ciganda, who came back from a 5-stroke deficit at the LPGA KEB Hana Bank Championship to tie leader Allison Lee. Ciganda made a birdie in the first play of hole to defeat Lee and capture her first LPGA Tour victory. She was there, drained after her putt. After a ship from Lee put her within inches of clinching the title. But Ciganda finished the final round at 270 and at 10-under par for the tournament. Ciganda played well in the front nine, where she was 13-under par after beginning the day at 8-under. By the 10th hole, the Spaniard led Lee by 5 strokes. But the 26-year-old faltered at the 14th hole and continued to struggle. Lee, on the other hand, was gaining ground after struggling early on. This was back and forth there, but both players struggled on the 18th hole. Ciganda failed to make par on the hole, and Lee saw her approach land in the water. Lee was able to make a bogey in order to force the playoff. Seong-Sean Fong and Min Sung Kim finished tied for third at 8-under par. Other notable scarce security 7th, IK King T10, Arya Yutanova and Lexi Thompson, Ingi Sean and Song Hyun Park T13. Suzanne Pedersen, T39, Lydia Ko, T51, and Brooke Henderson, T56. Obviously, Arya, Lydia, and Brooke are very tired of this long season for them. And speaking of Ingi Sean, with 6 events remaining in the LPGA season, she has mathematically clinched the 2016 Louis Sox Rolex Rookie of the Year Award. Sean's current 778-point lead over Megan Kang would mark the third largest margin of victory in the history of the award, trailing only Carrie Webb, over Mayumi Hirase in 1996, which was 1,030 points, and Sari Pack over Janice Moody in 1999, which was 929 points. Kang and Gabby Lopez, who sit in third place, are only scheduled to play in five of the remaining six events, mathematically eliminating them from the Rolex Rookie of the Year race. I mentioned in there Sayri Pack. Well, you all know she's a legend, and she ended up her Hall of Fame career in tears Thursday in front of her adoring fans during the tournament. Overcoming at the end of the sunny afternoon sky 72, Pack cried nearly throughout the retirement ceremony on the 18th hole. The Little Angels children's choir sang, players wore Sayri hats, and farewell messages were played in a video montage. It mattered little to the fans and players, many of them drawn to golf by Pack, that she shot an 8 over 80 and was tied for last, 15 strokes behind then leader Ellison Lee before she withdrew. She has been hampered by left shoulder problems, and 39-year-old Pack said in Phoenix in March that this season would be her last, and she stepped away as planned after the first round of the tour's lone South Korean event. Pack won 25 LPGA Tour titles, the last came in 2010, and five majors, two of them during a rookie season in 1998 that gave women's golf its biggest boost since Nancy Lopez. The youngest player to be inducted in the World Golf Hall of Fame when she was enshrined in 2007 at the age of 30, Pack won 14 times on the Korean LPGA and captained South Korea's Olympic team, with Indy Park winning the gold medal in Rio this year. Pack last played on the tour in July, also shooting an 80 to miss the cut in the U.S. Women's Open. You might remember Pack Mania ruled the summer of 98, especially after she won the U.S. Women's Open in a 20-hole playoff against amateur Jenny Chu at SC Point. When Pack returned to South Korea that fall, she had to be hospitalized for exhaustion. Television cameras came into her hospital room to give the latest news. Pack was a catalyst for more young players to believe they could compete on the strongest circuit in women's golf. Today, six of the top 10 players in the world and 22 of the top 45 are South Korean, and all that is thanks to Sayri Pack. So we wish her the best in her retirement, the best in whatever she wants to do right now, and she will forever be remembered for her contribution to women's golf. And finally, on the Symetra Tour, Nicole Brock Larson won the Symetra Tour Championship on Longwood, Florida on Sunday. The 23-year-old Dane closed with a 67 at Alachua Country Club to finish tied with Allie MacDonald at 18-under before defeating her with a birdie on the first playoff hole. MacDonald finished second on the 2016 money list, becoming one of the top 10 earners who secured their LPGA Tour cards for next season. The other nine were Madeline Sackstrom from Sweden, Jackie Stolting from the U.S., Wichanini Chai from Thailand, Laura Gonzalez Escalon from Virgin, Sherman Santiwiwa Satana Pong from Thailand, and I want to hear broadcasters mentioning her last name this year. Dana Finkelstein, Marisa Steen and Nelly Korda from the U.S., and Fred, last but not least, Fei Yun Chien from Chinese Taipei.
Yeah, you mentioned Sayri Pack retiring, playing her last round there in Korea, and we know Sayri very well in Toledo. She won the old Jamie Farr, which is now the Marathon Classic, five times, Carlick, last time coming in 2003. So she loved Highland Meadows and performed very well there. Some good names came through. Jackie Stolting has been on the tour before. She came through the big break. Nelly Korda got her card. She slipped into the top 10. She was just outside, but... So we had somebody new to watch for next year. Hey, the World Long Drive Championship was held last week. Perhaps you saw it on the Golf Channel. These are the linebackers and the tight ends of the golf world that can hit the ball over 400 yards. It was held last week, featured an 80-man field in a match play format. It was narrowed to 16 competitors ahead of the last 2 days of back-to-back nights coverage on Golf Channel. The champion, Joe Miller, won the first-place check of $125,000. Miller's 31. He's from London. He won his second long drive title by defeating Ryan Steenberg from Rochester, New York, Seaberg hit first, posting a drive of 412 yards. Carlos, that's a drive of 3 wood and a wedge for me. Miller, who in his previous rounds had hit 2 drives of more than 435 yards, smacked one 423 to win the championship. The event was held at the Windstar World Casino and Resort in Thackerville, Oklahoma. Tom Pappard bested Dan Lambert to win in the Masters division. These are the old guys. And for the women, Phyllis Melty beat out Chloe Gardner to win the ladies division. Carlos, I think that wraps up the backspin for tonight.
And with that, we'll take our first short break. And when we come back, we have the Par 5 news. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the Par 5 news. And Fred, who is going to top our Par 5 news? I think it's somebody that's not very known, right? You're going to talk about somebody.
Top of the Par 5 news, it can only be one of two people. It can only be Tiger Woods or Donald Trump, right? I mean, that's what it's got to be. It's got to be one of those two. We talked about Tiger last week, so let's talk about the Donald this week. Old information about Donald Trump making lewd locker room comments about his molesting women as women's groups around the country in an uproar as the latest presidential topic over the last week. Those same comments bring up a dilemma for the USGA as Trump Bedminster is scheduled to be on the site of the 2017 U.S. Women's Open next July. Do they or don't they? Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey is only an hour drive from New York City and just a 10-minute drive from the USGA headquarters in Far Hills, New Jersey. This was going to be a crown jewel event in the nation's biggest market next summer. The U.S. Women's Open is the richest and most important stop on the LPGA Tour and one of the most widely watched women's golf tournaments in the world. What message is sent to women around the world if the USGA hosts a ladies' tournament on a course owned by someone who outwardly bragged about sexually molesting women? Christine Brennan of USA Today in a column wrote that the USGA must move the tournament from a Trump-owned course. Carlos, as all of these media-driven events, I think this is overdone. Anything that I hear or read during a presidential campaign, I tend not to put too much credence to. Plus, I am a registered dirty old man and understand some guy bragging in the locker room probably was just talking out of his hat. But in today's media-driven and politically correct society, this is exactly the type of story media loves to dwell on. I'm sure the USGA is seriously considering moving this event, but how do you move something that has been in the planning for over 2 years? There are a ton of contracts and subcontracts from transportation to catering that are given out to successfully hold an LPGA Tour event of this magnitude. How do you undo all of that? In a related story, The Guardian is reporting that Donald lost a substantial amount of money in his Scottish golf properties. Trump reported losses of $31.8 million in building his golfing empire in Scotland and thus has avoided paying any UK corporation tax on either of his two resorts. The latest accounts filed to the UK authorities for Trump's two resorts in Aberdeenshire and Turnberry also show he has sunk more than $125 million of his own money into both businesses. Despite losing increasing sums on both investments, the account suggests he may never make a profit on either resort, although the Trump family insists Turnberry will return to profitability in the short to medium term. You know what? I'll bet Donald has wondered several times over the past couple of months why in the world he ever did this idiotic run for president in the first place and just opened himself up to more and more inspection and just, why would anybody want to do this? It's just ridiculous to me, Carlos.
You know, I truly believe that he got into it just to get some attention to his issues and other things that he truly thinks he believes on. And I don't think even him thought he would go this far. But now he's doing it.
I think you're right.
And he has to complete it all the way. I mean, there's no way he can step back now. And truly, he caught up. He got higher. And, you know, I truly believe he didn't expect to this road this far. But hey, well, he's in it, and I really believe this has been a race, a weird race for the presidential race, and like any other time in history. And I just can't wait for it to be over so we can just move on. For other reasons, I'm working with elections now. But anyway, we'll talk about that other time.
But anyway, though.
Hey, you know, there's executive drama on the European Tour High Office. A reader of Jeff Shackelford brought up to his attention Joseph Kurdi's Daily Mail history, a story on an employment tribunal involving the European Tour versus Scott Kelly, who's 61 years old, and a former lieutenant under George O'Grady, fired by the new chief family. Kelly is alleging age discrimination. Scott Kelly traveled the world attending high-profile tournaments for two decades. He forged close relationships with important figures, including Prince Mulay Rashid of Morocco, and even brokered a £126 million sponsorship deal with Rolex. But he claims to have been dismissed by the tour's new chief executive, Keith Pelley, after he was told to stop attending major events, including the Solheim Cup, which is the female equivalent of the Ryder Cup, and adopt new data-based approaches to gather sponsorship. The tribunal, in reading, heard that Mr. Pelley wanted group marketing director Mr. Kelly to use computer programs to attract new partnerships. He said he was even asked to take an 80% salary cut and retirement options, which he, of course, refused. The story goes on and on about the case, documenting the shift in sales approach and other interesting tidbits about the Pelley approach. On the surface, this has all the making of a possible age discrimination case. We will leave that to the courts to determine, and we'll keep you up to date in any developments in that story. But I asked a friend of mine who's an attorney, and that is his specialty, and his opinion in this case will not go far. Is that it will not go far. Kelly was being asked in principle to update his approach to business to the modern world, one where you don't need to travel as much and can be present through video conferences and other collaboration tools anywhere at any time, as well as use the new analytics and technology used to understand new trends and seek out potential sponsors that are based on it. Whether he was offered training on it and refused it, or not offered at all, that could have some base on it. But the only issue would, and it would depend on what the circumstances of his contract really are, is the pay cut and the retirement options. Even there is an issue that would depend on the contract he's under, and there are still ways that could be achieved successfully in favor of the European Tour. Fred, for me, who work in the technology field, and I may be wrong on how I see it, but I've seen this happen way too many times. This is the case of an old guard staffer with the old guard ways who really refuses to get on with the modern ways of doing business and simply gets overrun by them. Whatever it is, it's interesting as we see that Pelley, on his move to infuse new life into the European Tour with all his innovations and new ways, is not afraid to even shake off the tree in his own high office staff.
Yeah, you know, it is kind of a curious look into what's going on. And, you know, when you've got somebody like Keith Pelley coming in and doing, changing just really way things are done, it's just, you know, you're really shaking things to the core with those old traditional Europeans. And I got a couple questions that, you know, and I know you've followed this, and I know you're a Keith Pelley fan. Do you think Pelley is maybe going too far, you know, to grab interest, more interest for the European Tour? And do you think that the rather conservative European Tour fans are going to accept kind of the wild things and ideas that he proposes?
You know, he has to make something different for the European Tour to really caught up with the modern times and really try to caught up more with the PGA Tour. Right now, what I see from him, and that's what I like about him, he is changing. I mean, if you keep doing the same thing, what is going to be with the European Tour? It's going to disappear. Really, it's not going to be anything. It's just going to be a small tour that is not going to attract anything. And he was brought in to really shake things up and promote the European Tour and get the growth of it. And definitely have to shake it, everything. And as you see, Kelley, the guy that is suing them, Scott Kelley, he was a lieutenant under George O'Grady, which is from the past administration. Of course, Keith might want, you know, his new ways of doing things. And I see it. To me, like I said, to me, all I see is that, of course, this guy, we used to do things the old way. I go personally to in person to do business and try to get my sponsors, but that's not the way it's done now. And Pelley is bringing this approach, this analytics and these new tools that really gets you to where the trends are and where the sponsors can be brought in. And you don't need to go there, to the places that he was going there. All I see is happening many, many times. I go to businesses everywhere, and I see the reluctance from a lot of high executives to accept this change of doing business. And definitely, to me, the way that he's doing it, he's attracting new fans. As you saw with the British Masters, the Hero Challenge, the Putty Master Classes, and the other event that they had, it's receiving a lot of praises. And at the beginning, everybody was like, really? You might think, like, that's going to attract people. No, it did. And even the interviews to the players while they're playing, that's something that you don't see anywhere. And the players were up to it. They're really open to this change. And he's gaining. He's gaining new fans for this. And I don't see it going down. I really see it going up. I'm following this story closely because I'm interested in all those innovations. And all I see is praise here, praise there. And unfortunately for Kelley, which is Scott Kelley, who is the guy that was fired, you know, you have to adapt to the new things. And if you don't, you know, that deserves this to happen.
Yeah, that happens in every business, especially today with the, you know, more and more technology being used. And, you know, some of the older people just, you know, they can't keep up. So that's just the way the time.
We're going to be talking about the future of television, and that involves something like this. There's going to be a change, and we're going to be talking about that. So that we're going to talk a little bit more about these changes and that stuff in technology as well.
Hey, Carlos, the new inductees for the 2017 class of the World Golf Hall of Fame were announced today. Two-time European Tour Player of the Year, Ian Woosnam, will join Davis Love, who tops the list.
Before you finish, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Kieran Clark must be right now jumping on there because those are two of his favorite players ever. So, Kieran, I know you're celebrating, maybe downing a pint of this. Congratulations.
LPGA standouts Lorena Ochoa and Meg Mallon. Do you know where Meg Mallon went to college, Carlos?
Where?
The
where?
Ohio State University. And TV commentator Henry Longhurst will also join Love in being honored with the induction into the World Golf Hall of Fame. They will be formally honored in the ceremony September 26th in New York City during the week of the President's Cup. All five passed the new voting requirements set by the Hall of Fame in 2014, with each receiving approval from at least 12 of the 16 members on the selection committee. The five were selected from an original list of 16 finalists. Love won 21 titles on the PGA Tour, his first coming at the 1987 MCI Heritage Golf Classic, his most recent taking place last year at the Wyndham Championship. In addition to playing in six Ryder Cups and winning the Players' Championship in 92 and 2003, Love's career was highlighted by his victory in the 1997 PGA Championship at Wynnebrook with the Rainbow present. Woozum, Wee Woozy, 58, rose to prominence in the 1990s, winning 29 European Tour events, playing a big hook, plus the 1991 Masters. He was also one of Europe's big five, along with Sir Nick Faldo, Sandy Lyle, and Bernhard Langer, who helped Europe turn the once lopsided Ryder Cup matches into a tense and heated competition. The Welshman played on 8 squads and captained the Euros to victory in 2006 at Celtic Manor. Lorena Ochoa only played 8 full seasons on the LPGA Tour before retiring at the age of 28. In that short time, she won 27 titles, including 2 majors. Her dominant run included 158 consecutive weeks as the number one ranked player in the world. And she will be the first player inducted in the World Golf Hall of Fame of Mexican descent. Meg Mallon won 18 LPGA titles, 4 major championships in her 23-year career, as well as playing on 7 U.S. Solheim Cup teams and captaining the American side in 2013 that lost in Denver. Longhurst wrote a weekly column for the London Sunday Times for 40 years, became what many consider the first golf TV personality by providing coverage for the BBC from the 1950s until his death in 1978 at the age of 69. The 5 new inductees bring the number of overall members of the Hall to 155. Some of the finalists that did not receive the required number of votes included Susie Burning, Johnny Farrell, Max Faulkner, Peggy Kirk-Bell. She should be in there. She should be in the Hall. I don't know why they don't do that. Catherine Lacoste, Graham Marsh, Sandra Palmer, she will be in sooner or later. Calvin Peet, Samuel Ryder, McDonald Smith, and Jan Stevenson, and Samuel Ryder will be in someday. I don't know if Jan Stevenson will make it. She's on the borderline. So, Carlos, we got a new World Golf Hall of Fame class coming in next fall.
And also, I want to end up this segment of the Par 5 News talking about the Player of the Year finally was admitted. Dustin Johnson was voted the 2015-16 PGA Tour Player of the Year by his peers. It was announced last Tuesday. He claimed the Player of the Year honors over fellow nominees Jason Day, Roy McIlroy, Adam Scott, Jordan Spieth, and Henrik Stenson. He also earned the Arnold Palmer Award as the Tour's leading money winner, with $9.4 million, and claimed the Byron Nelson Award for adjusted scoring average, which was 69.172. And Argentina's Emiliano Grillo, as predicted last year, was voted the PGA Tour's 2015-16 Rookie of the Year that was announced last Wednesday. And with that, we'll end our Par 5 News and take...
Carlos. No. Hold up. We got more. There's more.
You got to tell us about
Greg Norman's rebranding.
Oh, yes. I'm so sorry about that.
You're jumping ahead.
I'm so sorry, man. I'm so sorry. I don't know why.
You know, Greg Norman's rebranding and Tiger's rebranding, too. We didn't put that in here.
TGR. He's not rebranding. Yeah. He's just doing the 2.0 version of him now.
So.
And he's just creating that company that's going to be like
looks
the,
like
head of it. So, of his.
Looks like three little... looks like three little arrows to me. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me, but.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just the T and the G and the R looking like arrows. But anyway, like his namesake, the great white shark, Greg Norman, can't stay still. The Hall of Fame golfer last week announced a new name for his ever-expanding company, rebranding it as the Greg Norman Company, after being known for 30 great years as the Great White Shark Enterprise. The iconic shark logo remains, featuring an evolution signifying the company's ongoing growth and transformation. The Greg Norman Company has embarked on a corporate restructuring over the past several years to expand outside the consumer products and golf-related services. Today, the current landscape of GN, oh, it's shortened, includes golf course design, real estate, interior design, investments, wine, clothing, eyewear, beef, restaurants, and more, with announcements on new partnerships forthcoming. Consumers will see the newly established brand identity roll out across all businesses throughout 2017. Norman said, and I quote, "A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. My first step starting with the creation of Great White Shark Enterprises 30 years ago. Over the years, I have learned that no business can stand still. We need to build a company not just for today, but for the future. And I am thrilled to say that this announcement is just the beginning of many exciting new developments to come." End of quote. You know, the Greg Norman Company employed the services of Richard Kinsherbaum, lauded New York City creative agency NSG / SWAT, to lead both the creative development and brand architecture of the new company. One of the most successful athlete-turned-entrepreneur in history, Norman is widely considered a pioneer in athlete brand building. The internationally recognized Great White Shark won more than 90 tournaments worldwide, including 2 British Open championships, and claims the distinction of having held the number one position in the world golf rankings for 331 consecutive weeks. Norman achieved his success through his aggressive playing style, ability to embrace failure, and a never-settle attitude. The Greg Norman Company integrates this same approach to business with newly defined brand values of authenticity, passion, confidence, and leadership. The Greg Norman Company attacks businesses with the same vigor with which its namesake attacked the golf course. And the intentionally recognized brand consistently delivers the values that his name is synonymous with. Fred, Greg Norman Golf Course Design is the longtime full business member of the Asian Golf Industry Federation, and he knows that is the next frontier in golf.
Yeah, and he seems to have a pretty good foot in there. You know, he was involved in their Olympic startup and getting that going, and he's designed some courses over there, and so he does have his foot in Asia pretty good. Hey, Carlos, Hurricane Matthew, you know, caused the cancellation of some tournaments in Florida two weeks ago now. But, you know, it came up along the eastern seaboard, clear from Miami, clear up to North Carolina, did considerable damage to Hilton Head off the South Carolina coast. Harbortown Links is the site of the RBC Heritage Classic every April, and the hurricane uprooted trees completely destroyed the harbor and made a mess of the golf course. PGA Tour and course officials are assessing the damage and if they will be able to hold the annual golf tournament the week after the Masters. Nearby Kiwa Island escaped any major damage, and only a few carpets needed to be replaced in the Sanctuary Hotel. Kiwa reopened for business last Friday. Myrtle Beach sustained heavy damage also, and flooding of the towns around the Carolina coast made it virtually impossible to travel around the area. Seattle, Georgia, south of Hilton Head and Kiwa, has started cleanup efforts, and they are confident the seaside and plantation courses will be ready for next month's RSM Classic, the final stop on the fall schedule of the 2016-2017 wraparound schedule. We're into 2017, Carlos. That's the end of the Par 5 news tonight. Now you can go.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You know what happened? It was that, well, anyway, I messed up here, but it was, I'll explain later. Let's take a short break.
You just want to get into the topic because you want to talk about media and the future and your letter from 2026. That's what
we will. We will, but first we'll have a great interview that you had with Robert Kraft about where you are right now. So we're going to take a short break and we're going to go to that interview right away. So don't go anywhere.
Thank you for listening to the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the VIG, the very important guest of the week. And this week, Fred, you are in Alabama, and we have a great interview with Robert Kraft. I'm sorry here. Oh, my God. Sorry. Oh, my God. So, I got it. So, anyway, you have heard all of the wonderful things said about Arnold Palmer over the past few weeks, but Fred uncovered the story of him. How Arnold is directly responsible for buying into a vision and helping to bring golf to Southern Alabama, which has meant thousands of jobs and brought a continuing revenue stream to the area and a solid economy. Fred had an opportunity to visit with the man who's responsible for bringing golf to a small community in Southern Alabama, which turned the area into a golf mecca, winter vacation area for snowbirds, and one of the best retirement communities in the country with the help of a very special friend. You know who that is? The King, Arnold Palmer. So, Fred, tell us a little bit about what we are about to listen to.
Yeah, I am here in Gulf Shores, on the shores of the Gulf of Mexico, visiting golf courses and the best restaurants and entertainment the area has to offer. And let me tell you, it's a wonderful golf and vacation destination. They're continually upgrading the facilities, the courses, everything is great. You know, it used to be called the Redneck Riviera down here. People from Alabama would come down and spend, you know, spring breaks and things like that, but it is so much more now. I happened to come here several years ago with my wife, and really we really fell in love with the area. The beaches, along with the abundance of golf to enjoy and the restaurants and the amenities, it's just outstanding. I had the opportunity to meet the man responsible for turning a sleepy little South Alabama community into retirement, winter escape for snowbirds from the north, and a full-blown golf community. And he did it through building a golf course. But perhaps even the better part of the story is that he enlisted Arnold Palmer's help, and Arnie immediately struck up a friendship with Robert's father, R.C. Kraft, and Arnold agreed to jump into the project. So really a great interview, Carlos. I really enjoyed talking to him and hearing his story. Why don't you go ahead and play it, if you would, please.
Let's play it.
We are so happy this evening to be talking with Robert Kraft in Gulf Shores, Alabama. And I don't know if you've ever been to this area or not, but it's absolutely gorgeous. I was here several years ago, fell in love with the area, had a chance to come back this weekend, and am so happy to be able to meet really one of the people that is responsible for turning Gulf Shores into a sleepy little South Alabama community into a major golf community. Mr. Kraft, thank you so much for talking to us.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
You were telling us a unique story about how you and your dad bring golf to the area. Dad saw a vision maybe to move here from the Fort Myers, Florida area. He was a corn and soybean farmer. When you graduated from Auburn, you decided you wanted to be in the sod business, and you grew a sod on the farm, 800 acres that you had out there. And you saw a vision that you needed a golf course, but you didn't have any money and you didn't have any way to get it done, and the city wouldn't put a sewer line out there for you.
That's correct. We recognized an opportunity. Gulf Shores has forever been a summer vacation. destination. And it was obvious we had a lot of condominiums under construction, a lot of resort homes that were rented out. But it was basically a Memorial Day to Labor Day type of thing, and then it was over. Well, what way could we expand the seasons? Well, golf had been used in a lot of communities, Myrtle Beach being a pretty good example, of how golf was used to expand the season beyond a summer tourist season, using already the inventory that was already there in rental homes. And we needed an expanded season for all of our businesses that were trying to survive here. So golf was the perfect answer.
So you had the 800 acres, but it was north of town quite a ways, and there was no city services out there. And you went to the city council to see about getting a sewer line, and they were just excited about doing that for you.
Yeah, not exactly. In the beginning, when we started out, we were going to build just a golf course and develop the homes around it, but we did not have sewer lines under the Intercoastal Waterway to get to us, which was a couple of million dollar expense to get there. And when pitching it to the city council, in order for us to do this, they needed to bring the sewer and water to our front door. And they declined. They would not do it. And so we had a real dilemma. We couldn't move forward without sewer.
So your next step was to hire a consultant to come in and do a feasibility study about building a golf course out there. And he told you one of your solutions would be...
Well, he told us we needed a marketing accelerator. Well, I did not understand what a marketing accelerator actually was. And he explained it would be either a very sophisticated, well-funding marketing budget or get a signature architect that had a name that would give you instant credibility.
And your signature name that you thought was the guy to get happened to be?
Arnold Palmer.
So how did you get Arnold Palmer to come up here to build a golf course?
We found that he had just started a golf course management company, and that he also had course design and course construction, and we were needing a lock and key job. So I was able to coordinate and find Ed Binion, who was the president of Palmer Course Management, at his very first beginning. He did not have any golf courses under contract, and suggested that we were a lock and key need for Arnold. And he invited us to come down to the Bay Hill Classic and pitch our story to Arnold.
So you decided to go down there. You asked your dad about it, and your dad said,
"You got to be kidding me. There's no way Arnold Palmer's coming to Gulf Shores, Alabama."
But when you asked your dad to go along with you down to talk to Mr. Palmer about the project,
he said, "I'm not going to go down there and ruin my good name. Waste my time."
You went anyhow, and you took an expert with you, and you met with Arnold and his team.
I did. Actually, we met with Arnold and the head of his management company and his course design company and his construction company, and had a gentleman with him named Mark McCormick. And at that point in time, and this is in 85, and I did not at that time know who Mark McCormick was, but I did finally understand International Management Group and their relationship to Arnold and golf.
How did you get Arnold to come up here from that discussion?
Mark McCormick grew up in Cleveland and spent his summers vacationing on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and he was well aware of the opportunities on our coastal area here of the central Gulf Coast, and really thought that this was something that had merit. And we were trying to get them to come up here and at least look at us to be the very first golf course that would be managed, designed, and built all by Palmer companies. They didn't have any at that time.
So Arnold did, the date was set, Arnold jumped in a plane, came over, got out of the plane, and met your father.
Interesting opportunity there. My father was a lot like Arnold. He was a self-made man. Hitch up your pants and make it happen. And he wasn't that concerned about looking good doing it. He was just worried about results. And that's the way Arnold played golf. He didn't have the most beautiful, perfect swing, but he was going to get the ball in the hole. And my father had that similar philosophy about life and about business. We could figure this out. My father had no formal education, but he was a common sense guy, hard work, and understood how to make things happen and was determined to not fail.
You borrowed a couple of golf carts from the local golf course, the only one in the area, Gulf Shores Golf Club at the time. You brought Arnold out to the site. You jumped in the carts. Your father and Arnold got in one cart, and there you could see they were talking and yakking and looking around. All of a sudden, they made a left turn, went over to the sod farm. Then what happened next?
Well, we were actually harvesting sod in the area adjacent to where we wanted to build the golf course, and I had all of these photographers and all of our mayor and all of our local folks from town to follow Arnold around and go look at the golf course. And their golf cart, as you mentioned, veered off to the left. And the next thing I know, they're over looking at the sod harvester. And within a couple of minutes, Arnold and my father on the back of the sod harvester stacking sod. And I got this whole entourage of golf folks wanting to go look at the golf course.
Arnold came. Before he left, he said,
"We'll be back. We're going to build this golf course for you."
So you then went back to the city council and said,
I told them that it changed my story. Instead of, "We'll build a golf course if you'll run sewer to us," and they said no, I said, "We've got a different philosophy. If you'll run sewer and water to our front door, we will bring Arnold Palmer to town to design a golf course, and we'll change the way the world looks at Gulf Shores related to golf forever."
You got your sewer line. Arnold Palmer built 18 holes. You later added a second 18-hole golf course. There's the Peninsula Golf Course. There's Kiva Dunes now. There's Lost Key. This is a golf mecca down here.
We were able to develop with the help with this plan of the golf courses you mentioned at Gulf Shores Golf Association. Again, we went to Myrtle Beach and watched how they had been successful collectively organizing and marketing accommodations and golf together. We came back and copied that. You always copy the best, and they were in our area the best at marketing golf and putting together golf vacation opportunities. We created a Gulf Shores Golf Association under that same formula to create golf awareness in Gulf Shores.
So this was in the mid to late 80s. I think the first golf course opened in 1987. Can you give us an idea of the economic impact, maybe on an annual basis, that golf means to this area?
Well, I'll give you an example. The best one that I can tell you is our marketing budget as a community. At the time we started the golf courses and started about golf course management and operations, we had all of our marketing was done through our Chamber of Commerce, and they had about a $350,000 a year marketing budget for all tourism in Gulf Shores. After we formed the golf course operation, and with the help of Herb Malone, who's the head of our Gulf Shores Orange Beach Tourism, who was at that time the head of the Chamber of Commerce, we established a 2% lodging tax. And through that, dedicated all that money to marketing and advertising for our whole area, which included golf in the shoulder season opportunities as well as our summer. And today, with that 2% lodging tax, our marketing budget's over $9 million.
We've been talking about Arnold Palmer, of course, with his death and all the things that he's been known for. We talked about his philanthropy with the hospitals in Central Florida and all the good things that he's done over the years. But the economic impact that he helped bring to this Gulf Shores area has amounted to thousands of jobs, a vibrant economy, and tremendous tourism business here in southern Alabama.
Correct. And it really was the beginning of the change of our destination. And we have since then become almost year-round, and we have become diversified. We've got a lot of different elements of tourism. But if you look back in time, one of the biggest elements related to that was the formulation of this Gulf Coast Orange Beach tourism and the implementation of a lodging tax and a sophisticated marketing budget that was begun because of the Golf Association, which was begun because we had a name signature that everybody respected.
Yeah, I think that's an outstanding story. And Mr. Kraft, thank you again so much for taking a few minutes to talk to us.
You're more than welcome.
There you have it. That was an interview. Robert Kraft and Fred, that story that you uncovered there about Arnold Palmer is just an example of how many lives he has touched indirectly and directly because of something that he has done off the golf course.
Yeah, I just, when he was telling me that story during the evening, during dinner last night, I just was so taken with it. I said, I gotta get this story on tape so we can use it on the show. And a little side note here, Carlos, before we get away from this, Arnold and his father, R.C., became such great friends that, you know, the guys would say that work for Arnold, you know, whenever they were coming up here, you know, Arnold would jump in a plane and he would, you know, going someplace, getting to fly the airplane, that was the number one thing because that was fun for him. But then he would want to know, okay, who are we talking to and how long do we have to be there before we can leave? But when they were coming to Alabama to be at this location and talk to Robert's father, R.C., it was get to fly the plane, but okay, who do we see after this? Okay, cancel those because we're going to spend more time up here and spend time with R.C., and they became great friends. And when he died, when Robert's father died, after the funeral, they were back in the house, and Robert's mother was sitting with a group of ladies, and they were consoling her and talking about, her late husband. And Robert got a call on his cell phone, and it was Arnie. And he said, Robert, I can't, I don't know the house phone number. I'd like to get a hold of your mother. How can I do it? He said, well, she's right here. Would you like me to give her the phone? He said, would you please? And so he handed the phone over and said, here's someone who wants to talk to you. And it was Arnold, and he gave his condolences directly to Mrs. Kraft, and that's just Arnold's touch, that was just the way he was. So you have to see this area, and to think that he was really responsible for really kind of kick-starting it, just because he liked the guy that was involved. It's just a heck of a story.
It's amazing. It's really more of these great stories about Arnold keep coming, and you're just still more impressed about the man that he was. Anyway, with that, we wrap up our VIG, the important guest of the week, and with Robert Kraft. And now we're going to take our last short break, and when we come back, we have the practice range. Don't go away.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the practice range. Every week, Ed and I pick a topic, and each of us take our own shot at it. And this week, we're going to be talking about the future, really, of what TV is going to be. The cable, can it survive? How about sports streaming on them? How are they transmitting the impact of what is going to be happening for a long time right now coming up. So we have all different aspects for you, and you want to hear this. Fred, go ahead and kick off the section.
Well, yeah, Carlos, kind of a follow-up to last week's discussion. We started talking about the declining television audience for live events, such as award shows, baseball, golf, and the NFL football. So the Washington Post said that, well, TV's never going to be the same. And, it's really all over the news because, golf has been declining a little bit on TV, but the big news is the NFL is declining, and that just doesn't happen. So everybody's kind of running around going, the sky is falling, what's going on? So, one of the reasons for lower than normal television viewers on the network channels over the summer, could be the presidential election that's going on. I don't know if you noticed or not, Carl, but there's going to be a presidential election here in a couple of weeks, and so they're all over the news and all that stuff. And also another factor is the growth of the number of cable television channels. A Nielsen report from May shows that on average every home receives 189 cable TV channels, but really only watches about 17 of those. And for me, Carlos, I only need two. I need ESPN, the Golf Channel. That's pretty much all I need. But Nielsen showed that the number of cable channels in an average U.S. household has grown dramatically over the last 5 years, but the number of channels that viewers actually watch has hardly changed at all. The bundling of cable TV channels to consumers forces them to pay for channels they really don't want, but are forced to get because they're tied to the others that they do watch. Like for me, ESPN or the Golf Channel. With the proliferation of live streaming, like on PGA Tour, PGA.com, USGA, and the Masters, plus other sports channels such as Fox, FS1, TBS, TNT, consumers are beginning to revolve on higher cable bills and watching more sports events and live shows on their computer, laptop, tablet, or phone. You know, you've got Hulu, you've got Netflix, you got Sling, you got all this stuff that's available. You don't have to have the cable. You can get it all through internet. What does this have to do with golf? How we as golf fans will receive live coverage of golf events will continue to change. Live streaming over your phone, tablet, or other mobile device will continue to increase. What is really in play here is the high percentage of funding for the NFL, for golf, for Major League Baseball, that comes from advertisers on the network coverage. Football's traditional TV audience is never going to be what it was again, said Brian Hughes, a senior vice president at Magna Global, which tracks audience and advertising trends. You know, Carlos, you know, they always say, you know, if they build it, they will come. Well, if no one is watching, advertisers ain't going to pay for their stuff to be on TV. Thus, television revenue goes down drastically. This is having a huge effect on television contracts with NBC, Golf Channel, and CBS for the PGA and LPGA tours. They are considering opting out of the remaining couple of years on their current deals to lock in the best deal they can for a longer term going forward. That will give them more time to accurately assess the changes to media viewership. Another option is to produce their own content and, you know, do more live streaming of their events than selling the advertising time to the tour's major sponsors, or perhaps bundling that coverage into the cost of sponsoring the tournament in the first place. So, Carlos, for me, whatever the eventual outcome, this is a big decision for the tours and will have an effect on how golf fans view tournament coverage going forward. And I know you work in this area, you work in this industry, and you have some definite thoughts on it.
You know, I just got an email from myself 10 years from now because I know what's going to happen. And I sent this email to me back in the future, you know, so that I could read it to you guys today. So what's going to be happening? You know, and it starts like this. It's 30 years ago, in 1996, you actually used your TV to watch broadcast or cable signals live as things aired. 20 years ago, in 2006, you probably still had cable, but you probably also had a DVR, freeing you to watch programming at your leisure, much to the chagrin of advertising. 10 years ago, in 2016, you may or may not have decided to cut the coaxial cord. But even if you had cable, odds were high you complemented it with some kind of streaming service. But by today, October 18th, 2026, if you even remember what cable was, that's probably because you only see it at your grandparents' house. And yet, what we have now is, in so many ways, the same TV that was 10 years ago. The new year is a great time to pause, think about the months to come, and reflect on how we got to where we are today. In the world of TV, we've come so far, so fast, that it could make your head spin. All the change that brought us to where we sit today, at 2026, really began to snowball in a big way in late 2015. So in this year, this seemed like a good time to do a retrospective about the last 10 years and look how we got to where we are today. First, though, it would be remiss not to mention the two big technological developments that set us on this path, even though they happened outside our 10-year window. The first was the launch of YouTube over 20 years ago, way back in 2005. It was subsequently purchased by Alphabet Inc. back when the company was called Google in 2006. Prior to that, many attempts at internet video had been made, but most involved awkward downloads and non-forgotten tech like RealPlayer or QuickTime, all of which had reputations for bugging down users' computers and, frankly, just not working right. Ask your grandparents how hard it was to view trailers or other stuff in the 90s. But streaming video became a reality for millions when YouTube went big, and it laid the groundwork for what would come next. The other major development was the advent of subscription-based, bingeable streaming video. That came 3 years later when Netflix, until then a primarily DVD-by-mail movie rental company, opened up video streaming as a bonus for its customers in January 2008. 2015, though, was the year when the tide really began to turn, which is why it makes a great starting point for this. And why that was the year of the change? Let me tell you. That was the year when Comcast, the biggest cable company in the U.S., finally had more internet subscribers than TV viewers. That was the year when streaming video became more than two-thirds of all the internet traffic. That was the year when big broadcasters and premium channels alike began to offer streaming-only, over-the-top, which is called OTT subscription options. And it was even the year when Amazon took its first baby steps into being the cable company millions of us use today. As we sat here 10 years ago watching the clock turn over to start 2016, a few of the cable companies were starting to take their own steps out of cable. Comcast had a little baby streaming service in test, and a company called Time Warner Cable, then Charter, then purchased, by Spectrum in 2021, with 11 million subscribers, was considering dumping the cable box and letting its service start to be an app. The stage was set, although programming had been delivered in bundles of channels through terrestrial providers for 30 years. The age of the cord-cutter was ascended. Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu had proven that you could not only deliver programming without being linear, but it succeeded at it. Early shows like Transparent and Orange is the New Black paved the way for the online distributors to prove that they were just as much a prestige network as any HBO and consumers bought. All I can say to you by that is, for a long time, and that was the end of the email, but for a long time, Fred, TV was a fairly sleepy business. You had three major networks in the U.S., less so elsewhere, acting as gatekeepers, okay? Right now, I can tell you that back in February, the Federal Communications Commission approved a proposal to open up the current model of cable television subscription in the U.S., and that is allowing a drop, that is, this would allow a drop in prices by introducing software and hardware innovations such as enjoying cable subscriptions through video on demand systems, those from Apple, Google, and Amazon. That process of subscribing to a cable television provider in the U.S. has remained unchanged for the last few decades, but right now, those providers really are looking at what the change is going to be. Basically, what Comcast did when they announced earlier this year that they were launching an app for their use, which is provided by Xfinity, is letting you know that they are willing to let go of the cable system right now and go through an app. Because you talked about Nielsen, and I have a stat here about how many the hours of the people are spending right now watching TV right now, and in the past 2 years, they don't have the 2016 because the 2016 is not over, but 2013 to 2015, the average of time that the viewers are spending watching live TV has decreased by 25 minutes, and that's without knowing right now what's happening in 2016. I'm sure it would go lower than that. What is increasing right now is watching through your telephone, through an app, or through your computer. It's really getting everyone unbundled, which is the name of what is coming. And that is why so many of these sports tours or organizations are looking at it. And you saw that the PGA Tour is looking to step out of those contracts and saying, hey, I need to get into a new modern world and start streaming my own service. And that's how they're going to start getting the revenues. There's a lot of, you can say that there has been a decrease on that viewership, but it's because there is still not a way, a precise way to gather how many people are watching actually online. But really, when you heard Comcast that says, hey, I'm going to change my way of showing cable, Fred, you know TV is not going to be the same in the future.
No, and it really, I think it's kind of funny that, you know, this finally comes to light from everybody being shocked that the NFL viewership of the NFL is now on TV. And I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but I mean, I was in the cable TV office a week or so ago, and there was a fairly long line of consumers in there. And about half of them were canceling their service when they got up to the counter. They're just tired of paying high bills and paying for, you know, 100 channels or that they don't use. And so, you know, being able to pick and choose the channels, the stuff that you want to watch via a Roku or Google or whatever you're going to do, and you get Netflix and you get Hulu and you get Sling and you watch the stuff you want to watch, that's what people are going to do, Carlos. And then these other things like Major League Baseball and golf and football, they're going to do their own stuff. They're not going to be on network. They're going to have their own channels and produce their own stuff. Now, some network may do it for them. They may contract to produce it, but just like college football, just like the Big Ten, just like the SEC, they have their own channels on TV. The Big Ten makes so much money from that, they give a tremendous amount of money back to each school every year. That's why all these schools want to join the Big Ten. That's why, because it has such a large television audience. So that's the way, Carlos. You nailed it. You're in the business, you know, and it's fun to watch. It's a tremendous time in media right now. It not only applies to television, but we talked about it applies to paper media. And how, you know, just what we're doing, going out over the internet rather than being on a radio station. It's just a lot different deal, Carlos.
And that is one of the media that is gaining right now. Internet radio, on that Nielsen total audience report that I have from the end of last year, radio, internet radio, earned from, and it was in 2013, in quarter four, was 11 minutes, what the listeners were getting. In 2014, which is 2 years ago, it was up 10 minutes to 21. And in 2015, it was up to 28 minutes. So you see a trend of going online, and that's why the big providers and the people is just saying, hey, I'll pay for the internet, bigger bandwidth so I can watch video more. And two-thirds of the subscribers of Comcast were watching right now more on the internet than really on their cable company. So that yeah, right there should tell you that there's a change and a shift on how things are getting. Well,
yep,
with this, we'll wrap up, unless you want to say something before we close up.
No, I think that was a good coverage. Good job, Carlos.
Excellent. So let's now go to our final thoughts before we close the show. And let me tell you something. Central Florida Expressway Authority wants to rename one of the region's busiest roads after the legendary golfer Arnold Palmer, who, as you know, died past 25 September at the age of 87. The board voted last Thursday that the western part of State Road 408 should be called the Arnold Palmer Expressway. The change is subject to approval by Governor Rick Scott and the legislature, which convenes again in March, but really there's absolutely no chance that that happens. Authority officials say that the section of State Road 407 named after Palmer would probably span west of Interstate 4 to near Florida's Turnpike, and about 40,000 to 70,000 drivers take that road on average a day, that according to the 2015 Florida Department of Transportation data. Another news, a piece of news, is that next month, $7 million Turkish Airlines Gulf opens to be doubt after the European Food said it was urgently investigating rocket attacks that happened last Friday in Antalya, the southern region where the tunneling is due to take place. According to the privately owned Dogan News Agency, two rockets were fired, apparently aimed at a fuel tanker. One hit a fish store and the other landed on an open ground, with neither causing casualties. The Turkish opened the first of three tour tournaments, and the season-ending finale is due to be held in Antalya from November 3rd to the 6th. And world number one, Rory McIlroy, is the top-ranked player due to compete, and this could be a very big blow to the race to Dubai finals on the European Tour. Hey, Brendan Dunes developer Mike Kaiser reportedly would add a fifth 18-hole course at the Oregon Resort, transforming what is commonly known as the Sheep Ranch, a 300-acre parcel, with a mysterious golf course a few miles north of Brendan Dunes. Kaiser opened Brendan Dunes in 1999 with one course and a little lodging, Pacific Dunes, the second course, opened in 2001, which was followed by more lodging and courses, Brendan Trails in 2005, Old MacDonald in 2010, Brendan Preserve in 2012, a 13-hole par 3 course, and a punch-hole putting course in 2014. Tom Doak is scheduled to build what would be his third design on the property, an 11-hole par 3 course, but plans have been shelved for now. According to Kaiser, the addition probably won't start until the first or second quarter of 2017, and there are even questions deep within the Kaiser camp about whether or not this addition is absolutely necessary at this point. Regardless, Kaiser relentlessly continues to grow his game. And finally, Charlotte Bates of Sky reports on Lee Westwood throwing himself into the ring for the 2020 Ryder Cup captaincy, believing, he says, that he's more than qualified after witnessing 10 different forms of captaincy. Thomas Bjorn continues to be the front runner for the 2018 gig of the righting of the wrongs of 2016. So, Fred, there goes my hopes of seeing golf's most interesting man, Miguel Angel Jimenez, captain in a Ryder Cup team, because there is somebody that is more qualified than anybody, talking about politics, right? More qualified than anybody to be the president. No, I mean the Ryder Cup captain.
Yeah, but he's not part of the Chubby Chandler group. You know, that's how things work over there. Hey, Carlos, Golf Digest published its 2016 Top 100 Golf Course list. The trend in rating the top 100 courses, evidently, is the proximity to the sea. 46 of the top 100 courses are oceanside venues, including the new number one Royal County Down in Northern Ireland. Two of the hottest new layouts on the globe, number 19 Cabot Cliffs in Nova Scotia and number 24 Cape Wickham in Australia. We had Mike DeVries on the show talking about Cape Wickham, if you remember. That count doesn't include number 51, Whistling Straits, or number 68, Gosser Ranch, both in the U.S., or number 75, Lake Course at Spring City in China. They're great courses, too, but adjacent to lakes or inland bodies of water, not oceans. The trend is clear. Seaside venues bring out the best in golf course architecture. As I mentioned, Royal County Down in Northern Ireland moved up three spots from last year to sit atop the new Golf Digest ranking. Augusta National, you may have heard of that little place down there. They host a little tournament every April called the Masters. They slide up one spot to number two, while Pine Valley moves from number one to number three, and Cypress Point drops to number four. Royal Darnock tops the Scottish courses to round out the top five, and Royal Melbourne in Australia is number six. Shinnecock on Long Island, the old course of St. Andrews, Muirfield in Scotland, and Marion in Philadelphia finish out the top 10. As I mentioned, Cabot Links comes in at number 19 as a new course. Trump Turnberry is at number 22. And Mike DeVries' Cape Wickham, as I mentioned, is number 24. Many familiar names fill out the listing, but Golf Digest does its best to rate the top courses in the world. Carlos, this is a little funny, but Justin Thomas posted a Photoshop picture of himself on Twitter and Instagram of his enlarged biceps and was immediately rewarded by the PGA Tour with a drug test. Thomas made light of the requirement on social media. He also announced that he would donate $250 for every birdie he makes in the next three events, the Safeway Classic, the Safeway Open last week, the CMB Classic this week, where he's a defending champion, and the WGC HSBC Champions. He's going to donate to the Convoy of Hope, which benefits the victims of Hurricane Matthew. Cobra offers a new line of single-length golf clubs. If you'd like to try Bryson DeChambeau's single-length golf club concept for your game, Cobra has released the first DeChambeau unique iron composition to the general public following the unveiling of the King F7 one-length and the King Forged one-length that were built at 7-iron length, which is 37.25 inches. Bryson said, "I approach the game of golf a lot differently than most, primarily from a scientific standpoint. I have more technical unique swing than many other players, but there is a misconception that a single-length irons are only for single-plane swing like mine. That is simply not true. Regardless of how you swing and what your skill level is, you can benefit from the simplicity of a constant-length set of irons." Hey, we got some Phil Mickelson news. Phil says he's not done and guarantees he will be on the Ryder Cup team for France in 2 years. Talking with the media prior to the Safeway Classic last week, "It's been 22 years since there's been 10 Americans that have been able to beat me out to make the team. So I don't know why it would stop now. Where would he play? I plan on being on a team in France, and absolutely one of my goals is to play in France because I've never been on a winning Ryder Cup team over in Europe. I want to win a Ryder Cup over there, and I want to be part of it as a player." Also, Phil got a new gig. He and his family will be getting a new home in West Virginia. He is the new tour ambassador for the Greenbrier Resort and will become a member of the Greenbrier Sporting Club. The five-time major champion joins golf professional Meredith Lee Trevino and fellow club member Bubba Watson among the stars that represent the property. Mickelson becomes a part of the tradition that dates back to Sam Snead, who was the Greenbrier's first golf professional emeritus. So, what else we got here? I got one more thing. Titles remains the number one ball on tour. There's no question that the Titleist is the number one ball, and now that the 2015-16 season is in the books, the numbers for Titleist are pretty eye-popping. PGA Tour players use Titleist Pro V1 or Pro V1X a whopping 3,643 times during the last season, compared to 566 for the nearest competitor. So, you know, like six times more for Titleist. Using Titleist balls lost 21 titles out of the 43 or 44, whatever the number is, including major championship wins by Jimmy Walker and Henrik Stenson. The next closest brand of golf balls had 8 wins. So, Carlos, that wraps up the final putts for October the 18th, 2016.
And with that, Backliners, we'll wrap up another week of the Backline Report presented by eDraft.com. Thank you for listening. It's always a pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Special thanks to our VIG, very important guest of the week, Bubba Craft. Don't forget to join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Blog Talk Radio, or if you missed it, check it out on iTunes or tune in. And if you haven't done so, follow the show on Twitter or @EastAssBackNineReport with the number 9 in the middle. My name is Carlos Torres. Along with Fred Alvader, we wish you to be happy, be blessed, and happy to bring everybody.
Good night, everybody.